Set up recording. Okay. So last time we talked about the policy half of page replacement. So before that we had gone over the mechanics of, well, I know I need to bring in a new page, so I need to take out a page. How do I do that? By finding all the page tables and modifying it. And then we need to say, well, what page do we take out? And that choice depends on our metrics. So we've settled on starting by optimizing hit rate, and we learned that, well, we didn't actually care about hit rate. Hit rate's just how often something needs to be replaced. And it has a relationship to what we probably really cared about, which was throughput, because doing those replacements is expensive, but not every replacement was equal. We'll start looking at some of those issues today. And also, this ignores other priorities we might have. So like when we talked about processor scheduling, we saw that, oh, not only do I care about getting the most work done on my system, but I care about, for example, all the users getting a quote-unquote reasonable share of the system. And we took those into account. We might have sort of a different algorithm. Typically, you'd have that by sort of layering the algorithms we talked about with something to like decide between users, for example. We also looked then at this optimizing hit rate, and we talked about the ideal solution. So unlike many problems, we had a perfect answer, except we couldn't implement it. So the ideal policy is every time we need to choose something to evict, we evict the thing that's accessed furthest in the future. And this is great for hit rate and not implementable because our operating system, well, it could arrange to figure out what the program is accessing, though we learned that that was actually a little tricky. It certainly can't arrange to figure out what the program is definitely going to access. It can make some guesses, but it can't really figure it out. So We knew that this was the ideal, and we receded along the path of saying, well, we're going to have to make guesses. That's the best we can do. Can't do better than making guesses. And our key idea for making guesses was based on this working set model, that we realized that programs naturally just aren't using all the memory they can access. And generally, there's some sort of concrete set of their memory they're using based on what their code that they're in the middle of needs. And basically what we want to do is identify what that set is, cache that, and don't care about anything else. So when we do replacement, we want to choose things that aren't in any program's working set. And a way of doing this, approximating this, was LRU. If things are in the working set, they're being used in sort of a short time span. So if we look at things that are recently used and keep those, and take the least recently used things and don't keep them, that is evict them, this sort of approximates Palladius mean under the working set model, because it not being used recently is a good reason to guess it's going to be accessed furthest in the future. This also is the same sort of intuition we had if you took a course about processor caches and they talked about temporal locality, the idea that things that are used now are likely to be used in the near future. Now, LRU, well, at least we could implement it, but it's actually very expensive to actually track what's least recently used. So we don't do that. And you might think, oh, well, we're going to do these approximations, which turn out to be very crude as far as when we detect accesses, but that's fine because we were already starting with an approximation. This was a approximation based on this guesses to program behavior. Of course, it's not going to be exact, so we don't need to exactly figure out when things are used, you know, and possibly don't even need to do that to get sort of the best performance we can get. And we talked about two sort of practical approximations. One was the second chance idea, and one was the seek idea. Remember, seek was this idea where we had an active and an inactive list. And the idea is the inactive list we scanned for accesses. And the active list we assumed active until dropped off, until something dropped off the list. And in both of these, sort of the intuition you can have is that we're not checking for every access to get the exact order, we're checking for accesses in a time window. In both of these cases, the time window isn't determined by like looking at a clock, but it's determined based on how quickly we're churning through pages looking for more things to replace, but it effectively chooses a time window. In the case of second chance, it's based on sort of the size of memory. In the case of the seek policy, we're being more precise about the time window by adjusting the number of pages we consider inactive. So that's sort of our usual page replacement. And you know, I'm going to now talk about some topics where we're going to move on from our simplified model where we only cared about hit rate and where we assumed sort of reactive, that is, only replace, evict on a page fault or, you know, another or a read or whatever would trigger us to bring in something into the cache. So we were assuming that was reactive and we're optimizing for hit rate. So I'm going to optimize for hit rate based on this working set model. I'm going to look at relaxing this sort of reactive assumption and this idea of assuming we're dealing with the working set model next. But before I move on, any questions about these things we covered last time? Okay. So first, I'm going to talk about ways of not being reactive. You know, what you can think of is that our current, you know, setup, we were being lazy. We didn't do anything until memory was full and, you know, we needed more. And only then did we do that. But real OSs typically don't do this. They're more proactive. And there's a bunch of reasons for this. But one big reason is that, you know, we have time earlier on to do stuff on a typical like desktop system. You know, before I like launch a program that might need a bunch of memory, I'm probably leaving the system kind of idle, and it would be good to take advantage of that. And the other is that we're going, you know, doing relatively expensive operations, and we want to do them early. Now, I'm going to start by talking about probably a case where not only do we have a reason to sort of, you know, try to be more proactive for performance, but we also have a correctness reason. And this is with write back. So we mentioned that we want to track whether pages are what we call dirty, meaning that they've been modified, so we need to send them back to disk in order to not lose data. And for data and files, this is actually a problem which isn't just about performance. About when you do that. So, like, yes, we could say, okay, so have a Word document, for example, I'm editing it and I'm saving it. And if we use our policy that I'm only going to actually do anything about my cache data when I have to evict it, and therefore I'm not going to write it back right away, we'd be really disappointed if my computer loses power or crashes because, well, that Word document is cached. And of course it's going to stay in my cache because I'm actively editing it. And even though I'm saving it, well, I'm saving to the cache, and there'd probably never be a reason to save it. And if I never run out of memory, there might never be a reason to save it even after I'm done editing it. But this is typically not acceptable. So just from a point of view of losing data, like, we want to actually be more proactive than, you know, we have to be for correctness, you know, because people would really complain if saving a document didn't actually send it to disk for, you know, days or until you shut down. So typically, OS is primarily based on this concern about not losing data, will track and scan for dirty pages actively. They, even though it would be correct to just wait until you have to evict the page, check if it's dirty, they'll just actively scan, you know, check for dirty pages and try to write them back before it's a problem. And typically their policy will be based on how much data they're willing to lose. So one example might be that you say, okay, I'm allowing this to be 90 seconds behind, but if you save the document and waited a couple minutes, it should actually be on the disk. Or another example might be when a program closes the file, I'm going to make sure that as soon as possible after that, it gets saved, even though I'm keeping it in cache and don't technically need to do that. And this is just for correctness. But this is also going to help performance because later on, when, for example, I'm done working on that Word document and I do other things with my machine and we want to free up memory, now freeing up the memory that's used to cache that Word document is faster because it's already on the disk. I don't need to spend time waiting for it to be written to the disk. Now, this is with write back, you know, the thing we did with the dirty bit. There's also the thing we did with the access bit of actually choosing pages to get out of memory. And so far, you know, when we just do this when we allocate memory, and usually we're choosing pages which we think aren't actively in use. And an observation to make, if they're, you know, haven't been used in a long time and probably won't be used soon, we should be able to do this earlier without cost. And evicting a page is kind of expensive, even if we don't have to write it back, because we have to find all the page tables it's in, the other data structures, and remove it from that, and that can be a little disruptive. So something many OSs do is that they evict pages earlier in the background. And they even have an option when doing this, you know, could, you know, have page removed from the page table and not overwritten yet, and, you know, restore if accessed. So, for example, you could remove it from the page table in advance, assuming you're going to evict it. If your guess is wrong, well, it's actually not too bad to undo, but you're still saving time in the common case where your guess is right. The other thing you can do by evicting early in the background is rather than setting it up to be restored, you could zero out in advance. So if you're doing allocate on demand, we want you to allocate zeros. You know, that's an extra step. We could do that in advance, assuming we're confident that, yeah, I'm probably going to need this page anyways for something else and not the thing it was previously used for. And you could have it pre-zero to make it faster when the allocation needs to happen. And the net result of this, you know, should be basically that rather than changing page tables and so on, our allocation is removing a page from a linked list. And yes, we have to do all that, remove from page tables, possibly zeroing out or not stuff, but we did that earlier and hopefully in the background, hopefully when the user was doing things other than what's actively requiring memory now. So these are sort of this write back and non-lazy evictions are two ways where the OS can say, okay, I have a bit of time before you actually ask me for a page. I should take advantage of that and make that process go as smoothly as possible. So any questions about this process? This idea of writing back or evicting pages in advance. Okay, so that's about changing the timing. Next, we're going to look at the other half of this, which is that we were talking about hey, L or U, that's how we're going to approximate Belady's min. And this usually is absolutely the right thing. Like most of what our program is doing, if you want to guess what's going to be accessed soon, look at what was just accessed. But there's some cases where it performs poorly. And you can certainly construct artificial examples, and when I introduced LRU, I gave you one of those. But for thinking about this, we should think about, like, are there actually cases that real programs are likely to experience where, you know, we're going to get really bad performance? And OSs have discovered that the answer is, yeah, there are a few. So I have a list of scenarios here. And the way I'd like you to think about this question is, what is this LRU bad for? So this means, you know, LRU makes the wrong decision about caching. So, for example, it might be the case, for example, for the first case, code for handling out-of-disk space errors, if that's never used, LRU won't cache it. But that might not be a problem if it's never used. So it doesn't mean it's bad that just because it doesn't cache it. So the question I'm asking here is, for which of these is LRU likely to make the wrong kind of decisions systematically? So just give some thought about that. I'll give you a bit of time to think about sort of what are the decisions, you know, which of these cases, you know, are we going to get systematically either cache things which aren't useful to cache, you know, where actually it will be accessed too far in the future, or systematically not cache things which we should be caching. And I'll also take questions if people have them. And did I not make this multiple selection? I didn't make this multiple selection. Can I fix that? The answer is probably I can, but not without restarting the question. Yes, I made the single choice, which was a mistake. Okay. Let me fix the poll and, oh. Really? Edit. Okay, well that is horrible. Yep, there's really no way for me to actually just reuse the question as is without. But keep thinking at that, and I'll do that. So let's try this again, and I'll be quick about this since you had time to think while I was fiddling. It's meant to be multiple choice. That makes a lot more sense. The answers I'm seeing. Okay. I'll give like another 20 seconds. Okay, so we have some consensus here. So let's think about this. So we have consensus about these two cases. And sort of we have this big hint that they're too big to fit in memory. And if we think about what LRU is going to do, we have our sort of, we have our big movie. This is like the size of memory. If we're playing from here, the stuff LRU is going to want to keep around is like a sliding window that, you know, as we advance through the movie, advances further, but never includes the stuff we actually want to see next, even if we watch the movie multiple times. And if we think about downloading, we're downloading from beginning to end, the same sort of thing's going to apply. So this, in fact, is going to be sort of exactly the wrong policy for these long movies because of that. We're not going to, you know, get any sort of things cached well. And you might say, okay, well, we couldn't fit it in memory anyways. What's the harm in having this part cached? You know, this is cached, so other things can't be. Right? We're caching part of the movie, and that's useless, but there's other stuff that's we want to keep in memory, and presumably we'd keep some of that in memory instead of this piece of the movie. So then we get to our less consensus answers. So we have this answer here is the next most popular, and I think this is a good choice. This is a good choice. I think this is also a good choice. So here, it depends what we mean by parse when loaded. So if we always save, which we didn't specify, we weren't clear about how that worked. So if we always save, then parsed when loaded, you know, presumably this means copy into a data structure. So, like, we load the file, but we don't actually access it again from the file. We access it into the data structure, which we loaded it into. And if we save over it, then we never actually read the file ever again. But, like with the movie, we're going to save this file in memory for a while, even though it's not being actively used. So then our next most controversial was the shell's global variables. So for this, you know, it depends a bit more. If we're often launching shells, this will be great. It will be cached and we'll do that. You know, if we don't change the values and have lots of shells running, change initial values, this will be great. It might not be so great if we just launch, if we launch a shell only occasionally, yeah, and always change the value, maybe it's not so great. But if you think of something like Portal, where probably shells are being launched a whole lot of the time, it's actually pretty good, going to work out pretty well. It's going to figure out, oh, this is being used actively, and cache it. And that's going to be a good thing. Or if we don't change the values and we have a bunch of shells running, this will be a good thing, presuming we're accessing those values. And for frequently requested HTML files, if they're frequently requested recently, so means that they will stay cached. And they will be requested recently because they're frequently requested, so any time period we look at, they're likely to be not least recently used. For out of disk space errors, you know, probably not used, not used much, implies not kept in cache. And if we actually run out of disk space, LRU will actually do the right thing. Everyone's in their text editor gets the out of disk space errors, and we start caching the code to handle it then because it's recently used. So it probably does exactly the right thing for our code in the text editor. So any questions about sort of my assessment for these scenarios? And how this works out. I'm looking at the chat window, so to be clear. Okay. So we see in this two sort of common patterns. So one common pattern is reading things exactly once, like to load it into a data structure. Or doing these repeated scans of a large amount of data. And these are both actually really common in the real world. So it's something that our operating system should be concerned about, and that many real operating systems are going to have special cases to look at both of these scenarios. And there's sort of two concerns that we're going to talk about. So one is that in both of these cases, sort of, we have one access, then discard. So that's something we want, is that in both these cases, once we've accessed the thing, basically we're done with it, typically. And we'd like to handle that. So I'll talk first about handling that. The second thing we're going to talk about is this notion of scans, that we're going to want to do something special because this is such a common pattern, and our idea of looking at what was recently accessed does so poorly for it, we're going to want some special case to think about how we detect and deal with those scans. But first, let's think about this one access. So Linux actually has a replacement algorithm that deals with this. So I showed you that Linux did this in active thing, but that was for non-file pages. For file pages, Linux almost does that, but it has this special rule to handle this sort of scanning and single reading of files. And that rule is that if it's part of a file, we don't consider it active until the second access. So we kind of say, if it's only accessed once, it's going to be a higher candidate for replacing. We're not going to treat it the same as like heap or something like that until the second access. And by the second access, I mean the second time we detect the access bit or equivalent being sent. And the key idea here is to avoid, you know, polluting the cache. So before they do this sort of thing, you're going to get this phenomenon where you read a big file, and as we're reading the file, we're keeping the whole thing in the cache. And if you have other stuff on your system, well, that stuff is getting evicted, and those other programs all run slower because their data or their files get sent out of the memory to support this file that we're just actively reading right now. Because on LRU, we read the file as fast as we can, we're loading into cache as fast as we can, but we don't actually want to do that. So this sort of special heuristic is just precisely identifying, oh, this pattern's really common and LRU doesn't handle it, so let's have a special rule that hopefully works good enough to detect it. So questions on this special case? So for dealing with the scanning issue, we're going to look at being proactive again. And so far, our proactiveness was with taking things out of memory. But now we're going to look at Araxen, the assumption that we only load things into memory when they're actually accessed. We only load it when there was a page fault, you know, or a read, you know. And we want to do better than that. And this idea that, oh, scans are a frequent access pattern we have actually gives us a way of doing this. So let's say, you know, I have my movie player running, and here's what the OS sees. It's accessing page 4, page 5, page 6. Well, we can make a prediction as humans looking at this pattern. You're going to say, okay, probably next to 7. Like, maybe the program's going to surprise me and do 100, but I don't think the chances are very high. And so our idea is to look for these patterns and make this guess in the operating system and do what's known as read ahead, guess this and read it, read in page 7 before the program needs it. So we're gonna anticipate the program's accesses because when they're scanning through files like this, it's so regular that that's something we can actually do. And like you saw with dealing with single accesses, typically you're gonna have some heuristics, some guesses as to how to do this. And there's a bunch of rules we can come up with, and the details are actually, there's lots of considerations. So to think about that, let's go through our idea here about some options for doing read ahead. So I have 4 different plans here for doing read ahead based on reacting to accesses to a file. So, you know, X represents a number. So when there's a page fault for page 0, load 0 and 1 into memory, you know, read them from disk. Or when there's a page fault for any page greater than 200, read the rest of the file and have a bunch of proposals like this. I'd like you to decide which of these do you think is probably best. And I will tell you that all of these have problems. Like, none of them is perfect. And there's, you know, there's things, reasons to complain about all of them. Give another 20 seconds. Okay. So most of people seem to think D is the best option. I think probably it is, but there are some problems with all of these, as I mentioned. So I'll go through, you know, some things that I think are, you know, a little disappointing about each of these. So with D, so one issue is that if we think of how this works, if I'm going through a file in order, I'm going to read, say, 0 and get 0 through 200. And then next, I read 1. I didn't set as page table entry, so I get a page fault for it. And then I want to read in 1, well, through 201. And if I look at what's cached, I'm only actually going to read in one page at a time. So here we have, you know, after first set, one page at a time, which is going to be, you know, not effective use of devices. So we'll learn when we talk about how hard drives and SSDs work that they like reading bigger chunks. This ends up trying to read one at a time. It's maybe not so great. Also, you could say, you know, we're going to have extra overhead to set page table entries later, which we could have avoided. So we probably, you know, here in C, we're setting the page table entries earlier, which is going to make things a bit faster, but means that we can't detect accesses as soon. We probably want some in-between point. So the big problem with C is that we don't read ahead for X plus 201, and, you know, program has to wait. So the problem with this is that the program, when we get to page 201, it has to actually load that in on demand. We don't actually get keep ahead of the program, because by loading into the page table, we don't get proactively notified that, hey, you need to keep going to stay with the program. And in reality, we probably want something between C and D to, like, keep up with that. There's also the question of whether 200 is the right number or not. Then I have other complaints. So B has this attractive feature of, you know, first of all, we have an issue of, you know, getting files piecemeal. Here, we're reading the whole thing at once. So we're making currently the most efficient use of the hard drive. But this is bad for a large file. We might load too much into the memory, and we load stuff that the program's not going to be using for a long while. So there's a trade-off there. And with A, like, we're certainly not loading too much, but we have this issue that, you know, first of all, we're going to have a page fault, right? Probably we're going to have a lot of page faults. And the biggest question I would have is that we're probably not far enough ahead. Because, well, we're only going one page ahead, and the program can go through that a lot faster than we might be able to read it. Something that's wrong with all of these is, you know, is what if not sequential? So what if the program is not accessing sequentially? Well, we just didn't consider that, but that's actually something that we should actually figure out. Like, there should be some extra work here to say, is the accesses actually sequential before I start reading ahead? And the other is, you know, adapting to how quickly the program reads. Like, these kind of do it, but we're just using, like, sort of fixed numbers for how much we read ahead. We actually want to make that a more intelligent decision. So questions about sort of the critiques I have of these ideas before we sort of move on a little bit. So when designing a read-ahead scheme, you know, we have all these questions to answer, and there's these trade-offs with, you know, so we need to, like, we probably want to actually detect a sequential pattern, and we have to, like, monitor accesses that aren't misses, because the idea, you know, that aren't misses, at least, you know, not misses that require misses that require loading from disk. Because the idea is that the program never needs to load from disk on demand, but that needs to need to look at its accesses which aren't loading from disk. And we need to make sure we're keeping a track of, when I'm reading ahead, am I keeping up with the program? Am I too fast? Am I too slow? You know, we want to make sure we actually read far enough in advance to keep up with the program. And we want to decide the right amount, because if we do too much, we're going to, you know, evict stuff other programs actually need. And if we do too little, we won't keep up with the program. This is sort of a tricky thing, and OSs use educated guesses to figure out how to do this. Okay. So read ahead's the last topic I'm going to talk about with our page cache. So to review, we had this idea that we're treating most of our memory as a cache for the program data and files, and we lump those together because for both of them, they're going to have a home on disk. That's our master location for our program data and files, and we're going to keep them in memory when it makes sense to do so based on what's going to give us best performance. And in order to try to get the best performance, we needed to make a guess as to when would programs actually need that data. And for the most part, we assumed this working set model, where there's some set of stuff a program is using right now, that's what you want to keep in memory. Therefore, to measure that set, we track what the program recently used. And we saw that we had some special cases for these non-LRU type patterns like scans. And you can think from that, maybe I didn't give you the exhaustive list. OSs might discover other cases where there's things to do like that. We also mentioned that even though the simplest way of implementing the page cache would be that we just wait until the program needs to load something, that's not actually what we want to do. We want to be proactive. We want to write things back early, both for correctness and performance. We want to do this read ahead and pre-evicting things so we spend the least time when the program is actually begging for the data right now rather than wasting time earlier doing nothing when we could have been doing this work in advance. And as I alluded to, we talked about, you know, maximum performance, maximum sort of hit rate, but in reality, maybe there's some other concerns that we haven't talked about how we deal with. So before I move on, questions about the page cache and page replacement. So our next topic is going to be about devices. And first, I'd like to review something we mentioned earlier, which we're going to look at more detail, which is sort of how the kernel keeps data from devices. So we mentioned that we have devices like the keyboard, which just send data to the OS. And the OS is going to stash that data in some buffer it has. And when you actually read, it reads from that buffer. Possibly it waits first, and we'll look at how that process looks later. And for a file, we mentioned earlier that when you read from a file, it actually reads from into a buffer and takes the read from a file. We learned for files that this buffer is part of the page cache. This is for something like the keyboard, this is something else. It's the same idea, but it's not a page cache because we're not going to cache things you typed 10 minutes ago. That doesn't make sense. Once we've used it and got it to the program, we don't keep it around in the operating system anymore, unlike files. And we have sort of something in parallel with writing. So we print a character to go to a remote machine. It's going to go into a buffer if the OS has, and then it's going to get sent to the network eventually. And we mentioned having, you write a character to a file, it goes to a buffer that gets written to disk eventually. And we just learned what the buffer for the file is. This is the page cache. And this is, again, something else, because it doesn't make sense to have a persistent cache of stuff that I've already sent out on the network. So we have this in-kernel buffering and this sort of separation where we have sort of the system call and the actual, you know, device communication. And we're going to look at how that works in more detail in the rest of today's lecture. And recall that this gives us this layering, and we've had other buffering on top of this outside of system calls that we're mostly not going to talk about today. We just want you to remember it's there. Then we had our system call interface with like read and write calls and the kernel's buffering. And underneath it, we had this vague thing called device drivers, which is the things that know how to communicate with devices. We're going to talk about how those device drivers work. And one thing we have to think about is, well, how do device drivers interact with, say, our page cache and our file system? And that's kind of a special case in a typical Unix-like model. So we have this common system call interface with read, write, and mmap, and we have regular files, which is POSIX's name for like files on disk that hold data. And file systems determine how those regular files work on a disk that has many files on it, but that file system ultimately needs to talk to a device driver that knows how to talk to the disk. We also have other types of devices like keyboards, monitors, network devices, which are going to have their own, what we'll call device files, that talk to a device driver more directly. And we're going to be focusing for today mostly on this interface, but I'll talk about how this works very briefly. It's broadly similar. So for devices as files, the idea of the file interface, if you remember from way back early in the semester, is that we have this unified idea that we open it, we read or write, and close. And let's think about how that looks like for various types of devices. So here are some example device files that exist on my desktop. So one thing I have is there's a device file I have for audio playback. This is one of many. And the way it works is you open it up and write audio data to it with the write system call, and it comes out the speakers or the headphones or whatever. There's also some configuration, because you can think of, well, how do I figure out where it's going? How do I determine what format that audio is in? We'll talk about that in a second. There are also device files for my hard drives. Now, typically, you'd access these via the file system, but these are files that you can actually open, read, write, mmap, seek in, just like a file, except they actually map to the hard drive. So the device driver is providing an interface that kind of mirrors a normal file, but it maps to the whole disk. I also have device files that represent, say, my mouse and keyboard. And so I can open these up and call read, and I get in some format key press and mouse movement information actively happening. And I have a device file that represents my graphics device. So I activate this and I get something that lets me display things on the screen in some way. Now, for most of these, you can kind of imagine what read or write should do. So writing the audio data here should send it to the speaker. Reading and writing should modify things on the disk. Reading should read keyboard input. Writing presumably displays something on the screen. But there's some cases where we're going to run into problems because, you know, even though we might have sort of a main thing that read or write should do, there's other things we want to do. And we saw one of this with this audio output. So one thing I want to figure out is like, what's the format of the audio? Another thing might be, are the headphones plugged in? That's not really information we expect to read from something. That sort of doesn't fit in with the read or write API or mmap. For the terminal, for example, many of the terminals either in the device driver or in some for old terminals in hardware support echoing back what the user types. And that's sort of a setting, but it doesn't make sense that read or write would set that. We need some extra operation to do that. We think of like a DVD drive. We want to know, is there a disk in there? That's not like a read or write operation. If we think of reading as reading from the CD or DVD, then is a disk present is sort of this meta information that doesn't make sense to get through read or write. Or, for example, with a CD or DVD drive, we can ask to open the tray, but that isn't really a thing that makes sense to do with a write. So to support this, POSIX provides extra file descriptor operations, the most notable of which is IOCTL, which stands for IO control. And the idea of this is the device driver can define whatever extra operations it wants just to handle cases like this, you know, like these things where it doesn't fit in naturally with read or write. Another option that some device drivers might use is they might say, well, rather than having this extra operation on the normal device file, I can have one device driver have multiple files that all feed to it and have one of them be a control one. So for example, on Linux, there's a control device to configure audio settings for a particular audio output piece of hardware that is a separate device that manages, you know, multiple other device file. Device driver that manages multiple device files manages that control file, so you can have something where reading and writing to change those settings maybe makes sense. Now, I talked about this sort of interface, and fundamentally, our device drivers are just implementing this interface. So in Linux, for example, if you make a device driver that has a device file, you're going to just define, and this is a struct of function pointers, so you're going to define a read function, a write function, an IOCTL function, an mmap function, an open function for your device. And the system call implementations are just going to forward to this after identifying, hey, it's for my device, for this device here. Now, I told you that this was for device files and that file system stuff is a special case. And there's two reasons for this. So one reason is that disks and things like it have a different interface. They don't want to read or write bytes. They really want to work in terms of big blocks. The blocks are typically like around the page size. The other thing is that we really care about making these work well with the page cache. So in Linux, for example, they have a different interface for what they call block devices, which are things that we want to work with the page cache. And the main operation that block devices provide is not a read or a write, but this special read or write page operation, where the idea is that this is what's used by the page cache implementation code to say, hey, load or store a page. But in either case, you know, our device driver is implementing these operations from some list depending on the type of device it is, and it handles all in that how it communicates with the device. So questions about these operations and the choices of operations we have. Now, the code which handles the requested I/O is actually only part of the device driver. And we're going to split up the device driver into two halves. So we'll call the part which handles the actual read or write or page cache, you know, through, you know, a forwarded read call because this is a device call file, or through that, you know, hey, page cache, read or write page interface, whatever it is, we'll call that the top half. And this is all run in the thread that's actually triggering the I/O operation. And we mentioned that earlier that we had buffers. So basically what this is going to do is it's first going to check any of those buffers, see if it's satisfied, and if it is, it might just finish. If not, it might need to talk to the device. We'll talk about how that works in a bit. And it's going to wait, if it needs to, for the device to actually finish by putting the thread to sleep. And we'll talk about waking up in just a little second over here. And after we actually get the data, we're going to take the data from the buffer, store it into the result. And I have a return if result complete, because in some cases, like let's say I'm reading from the keyboard, I might detect, oh, I haven't gotten a new line yet, or I'm not done reading, so we might go back and try again, depending on what the request was like. So this is the top half, and this runs in the thread that actually triggers the I/O. We also have, not surprisingly named, the bottom half, and this runs from the trap handler. So this code runs in the middle of something else. This is triggered by an interrupt, and we're going to typically want this to be pretty short because we're taking time from something else that actually wants to use the CPU. So this is going to get an interrupt, and it's going to handle, the device said, hey, I have data ready that you requested earlier. So it's going to, update any buffers and handle, maybe it needs to wake up a thread and tell it to go and store the data to handle the I/O request. And possibly we might detect, oh, I didn't actually send everything that's in my buffers and finish that. So we have these two halves, and they're both important parts. And the part which is called from those interfaces I showed you earlier is all the top half. And we have a part which is called from the trap handler, which we typically want to be fast because it interrupts some other program, that handles like maybe more of the communication with the device. So we're going to look at both of these. We're going to start with looking at the top half of what the console device for reading keyboard input looks like in XV6. And first thing we need to talk about is device files. So like Linux, XV6 has a struct of function pointers for read or write operations for each type of device, and it just has an array of those. So there's an array of these, and the device has a corresponding file on disk, and we have an array, which just takes as an argument, and we have an array of the possible types of devices. So one question you might ask is, if I open up a file, how does it figure out it's for a particular device? And the solution that Unix in general and XV6 does is that we have a special file on disk that has an index into this table, known as a device number, and you can create that special file with the make node call. So this is, it's stored kind of like a normal file, but rather than saying it contains data, we say it's this type of device, and the OS knows when you open that to not try to read data from disk, but to give you this read or write operation that corresponds to the appropriate array index. And this is the similar to the scheme that like Unix or Linux use, except they don't have an array, they have something more like a hash table or something like that, and they have not one number, but two. But it's the same idea, we have this special file on disk which says, this represents a device, I'm just giving it a name, and here's the index to find the device driver in your running system. Okay. So we have this index, and XV6 has decided that index one in this array is the console. So at boot, it says, well, the console has a read function and a write function. We're going to focus on this read function. And this is going to be called when you rewrite the console. So code that runs on boot just opens up one of these special files that corresponds to the console, and sets that as your standard in, standard out, standard error. So when you read from standard in, you're calling console read. When you write to standard out, you're calling console write indirectly. So questions about this setup? So let's look at what our console read is going to do. So we have our first step is like we make a read or write system call, and some code that handles reads in general is going to figure out, oh, this needs to go to the device driver, and the device driver is going to need to check, first of all, well, maybe I already have the input, and secondly, if I don't, I need to start waiting for it. In the case of a keyboard read, we're not going to send the I/O operation because the keyboard's always reading. But for some other types of devices, we might need to do that. So here's the code in console read. So we get a size, we get where we put the data, and the first thing we do is we check, okay, is there any data in the buffer? R and W are pointers to the reading and writing location of the buffer. So then being equal means that there's no more stuff to read from the buffer, that we're waiting for stuff to be written. So what it does here is if we're at the end of the buffer, we put the current program to sleep until later. And if not, we're going to advance to some code later on, which is going to actually copy from the buffer. So let's say we had some data in the buffer and we skipped this while loop. In that case, we'd skip ahead to the code that actually stores the data into the result. So what happens there is we have our buffer, we get a pointer, get a character from the buffer, we copy it to the destination, which is, this is what was passed to read, and we keep going until we know we're done. In this case, we determine with just a static rule that is, we're done when we've read as much as the user asked for with read, or we hit a new line. That's just a rule that XV6 has decided on for how the console device works. The device driver could have made a different decision if it wanted. Okay. So that's the top half of the console device driver. So we wait for the buffer to fill by putting the current thread to sleep. If it's not ready, we copy from the buffer. We check if we've read as much as we want to. The rule is new line or enough characters. That's just what they decided. And if not, we repeat this process from the beginning, wait for the buffer to fill, and so on. Okay. So questions about this console read function part? Okay, so we have this buffer we're accessing, but we're missing the actual part which communicates with the device in any meaningful way, and that's going to all be done in the bottom half. And the first part of the bottom half for the keyboard always gets triggered, here from interrupt for the device. So in TRAP, there is code for handling the keyboard interrupt. The console actually has multiple types of keyboard-like input. We'll only look at the keyboard device and not the other one. So that's this case here. We have the TRAP number. This is just determined by basically the hardware that points to the keyboard. And what we do is we call this keyboard enter function, which is basically the actual device driver code, followed by a function call to tell the CPU, hey, I'm done handling this keyboard interrupt. Stop telling me about it. If we don't have that, the CPU is going to keep telling us, hey, you have a keyboard interrupt you should handle. And after we've handled it, we don't want it to do that. So let's talk about the actual device driver code. So here we're going to update the buffer we're going to somehow communicate with the device to read from the actual keyboard. And then we're going to wake up any thread which was waiting that was put to sleep earlier and have it do its store the data and so into the result. So that's what it does. But to look at the details here, we need to go to this tricky question, which is how do we actually talk to the device? And to know that, we have to think of how is the device connected to our machine. So simplest way we're going to connect the device is we're going to reuse something we saw earlier when we talked about sort of cache coherency, which is that we're going to have our memory and other processors connected on a memory bus. And hey, if we already have this communication line which supports multiple entities, why don't we attach a device to it? And we won't actually attach the keyboard to this. We're going to attach a device controller. So this is going to be an intermediary that this might understand how the keyboard works via some interface we're not going to talk about. And it's going to translate it into something which works on the memory bus. Okay. And this device controller is going to expose sort of control registers. So here we might have a status control register saying, like, do I have key presses waiting or not? For something like a network card, we might have control registers that are kind of magical. So note that the way these control registers are going to work is that we get something in on the memory bus, and the device controller decides what to do with that. So one thing it's going to do is it's going to choose a memory address for each of these control registers. And all it's doing is it's comparing what comes in off the memory bus to that address and deciding where to put it or where to take it from for a read. So the device controller can make these registers look like memory. And because the device controller is involved in determining, you know, when these reads or writes happen, it doesn't just need to say when that this acts like normal memory, it can make it do something special. So for example, let's if this was say a network card, or you know, we could say that when you write to this memory location labeled write ? That rather than updating a value, we're going to actually send something to the external hardware. And that's something we can do because we're just making hardware which interprets the write command that comes in off the memory bus. And we can make that do whatever, you know, makes the device useful to the OS. Another thing we're going to have besides these control registers, which is going to tell us like about status and allow us to trigger operations, is we're going to have buffers or queues. So like for the keyboard, we'll have like, here are the recent key presses. So we'll have another buffer on the device, and these also will have memory addresses. So as we'll see later, when I went to read what was the last key press, I'm going to read from this buffer, which is going to be assigned a memory address. And we're just going to read it like normal memory, but it's actually going to go to this device controller. So that talked about communicating. There's one thing we're missing, which is that, well, you know, I mentioned we have these interrupts and we need to make that happen. So probably, you know, sort of in parallel with the memory bus, you know, maybe part of the same bus, we're going to have a way of signaling interrupts. And this is how the device controller arranged for that interrupt handler to run. So the device controller decides when they tell the processor, hey, I have, please interrupt. And we'll send that signal either in the memory bus or on something that's sort of alongside it. So questions about this idea of sort of mapping these control, you know, values and signals to memory addresses and letting the processor access them that way. Okay, so something I kind of glossed over with this, sorry. The question is, so you could do a move instruction? Yes. So our device driver code, you know, to access this status register or to trigger a write is going to do a move instruction, just like normal. It's going to do a move instruction that goes to this physical address. Okay. So I kind of simplify things here by saying that every device is going to be on our memory bus. Often there's some indirection, so we'll have what I'll label as a bus adapter. And, you know, the bus adapter is going to translate what the device controller accesses, you know, sorry, translate from the device controller that communicates on a different bus to the memory bus's, you know, sort of interface. So this is commonly what you'll see. So for example, if you know about USB, like basically this is what's going on with USB. We have something possibly connected to the memory bus that translates between USB and what the memory bus expects. So this is often what's really happening. We're going to just think about this scenario to keep things simple. So we can think of these devices, device controllers, exposing the device as sort of magic memory. So with our keyboard controller, for example, there's some memory location we read from, and we get the last key press or release. And because the device controller determines how this memory location works, it can do things which are very sort of magical and don't work like normal memory. So for example, a common thing is that reading from this location to get the last key press will clear it and set it up for the next key press or release. And that makes sense because that's what we're going to want to do anyway. Why require an extra read or write? We can just do that automatically. And because the device controller determines how the memory works, that the memory that's not really memory works, well, that's something we can do. And we can also, you know, arrange to get an interrupt when there's something you haven't read. The device controller can figure out if you've read it or not. We can have a display controller where you write to some memory location and it just gets displayed on the screen right away. It doesn't need to scan, figure out when you've done that. It just knows when you've written because you're writing directly to the controller. And we can have other memory locations which, when you write to them, change the format of those things to display, and it can act immediately on that because it knows about when that happens. Or we can have a network interface where you say write to some buffers, and when you write a signal to a special memory location, it sends all those buffers right away. And that's sort of the way you actually talk to the device. That's sort of So this special memory, which does special things, is the interface these device controllers can provide. Now, you mentioned that, we can just do a move instruction to access these, and that's true. There are some nits about that. So one issue is that caching. So I have some physical memory location that corresponds to the last key press or release, and let's say I press H, the OS reads an H, and does it get cached? Well, if we think about typical processor caches, it would. But let's say I press E. The OS reads. It's going to read from the cache if I don't do anything. And that's a problem, right? We actually want to get the magical behavior. We don't want the cache to make it not behave like the magic the device controller is trying to give us. And one way we could imagine fixing this is we could imagine the device controller would implement the cache coherency protocol we talked about and invalidate the caches, but that is typically not what's done because that's just too complicated for the device controller. So instead, we're going to have the OS tell the processor, hey, I'm using this memory address to talk to a device, please don't cache it. So in x86, there's a way of doing this. There's a bit in every page table entry which says no caching, and if that's set, then the processor won't cache accesses that use that page table entry. And that's a way that we can arrange that when we read that H and we read again, we're not going to reread the H. The processor won't cache it for us as long as the OS gives this proper signal that, hey, this is special memory. Don't try to cache it. It doesn't work that way. So I'm going to finish up by talking about sort of how XV6 accesses the keyboard using these special memory locations. And unfortunately, I have to go through an ugly historical thing about x86. So I talked about, hey, we're just going to connect everything to the memory bus. That's great. It makes things very simple. We already know how to access memory. And this is what most recent processors and devices do. Unfortunately, there's a history of having a separate bus from the processor, which basically works like the memory bus, but just has separate addresses and separate instructions to access them. And this is what XV6 uses to talk to the keyboard, but it works the same way that a more modern system would work, where you'd access the device through the memory addresses. You just have different instructions. So they have these in and out instructions, which basically are like the move instructions, but they use different addresses. So, and it works the same kind of way in the hardware. So, sorry for that disconnect, but we're dealing with history, and the simplest thing that XV6 could use was this older interface with these sort of kind of historical address, extra addresses, which are still supported because of backwards compatibility. So in that scheme, there are two control registers that are relevant for the keyboard. There's a status register with address 64 hex and a data buffer with address 60. And the way this works in the interrupt handler, so this is in the keyboard interrupt function, is that we read from the status register, and one of the bits of the status register indicates there is data in the buffer, DIB. If there's not, we return, just say we're done. If there is, we can read from the data buffer, and this automatically clears the data buffer. We get the data, and the code that I'm not showing after this interprets the raw value from the device controller and turns it into a character in the buffer. So questions about the process I'm showing here? Okay, so this is where I'm going to leave off for today. So next time, we're going to talk about other ways of getting data from devices and start talking about how file systems work. Okay, assuming I don't get any questions in